This podcast is recorded on the traditional and unceded territories of the Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh people.
British Columbia, I've seen your mountains high, seen your pretty rainbows and your blue crystal skies, watched your winding rivers as they flow around the bend. To me, you're not a stranger, you'll always be a friend.
Coming to you from the West Coast, this is Politicoast. Today is November 28th, 2019, and this is episode 166.
I'm Charlotte Lundeboom.
And I'm Ian Bushfield. On today's show, the NDP's convention and the quiet end to the legislature, roughly, shakeups in the federal opposition parties, and a little BC startup made international news again this week. First, let's thank those who helped make the show possible. There are now 75 people contributing every month. I've noticed that saying this exact number and talking about the one to two, three new people who sign up every week is helping. This week, past week, we had one new Patreon sign up. So go to patreon.com/politicoast, someone this week, and be the person who signs up this week. Maybe we can get two or three. Let's get three. And give us a share on Facebook and Twitter if you can't afford to support us. Editing support.
Or even recommend us in person.
Yes. I was doing that tonight, actually, at a meetup for Friends of the Pod, a Call to Question. They had a Patreon meetup. That was super fun. We'll have to do a Patreon meetup.
It's been a while.
Yeah. Editing services are provided by Cortado Productions. And as always, Politicoast is in partnership with BC Today, British Columbia's daily newsletter dedicated exclusively to BC politics. Sign up for a free trial to have unique coverage of the BC legislature delivered to your inbox every morning. Listeners to Politicoast, enter the offer code CITIZEN for access to a special rate. For your free two-week trial of the newsletter, go to britishcolumbiatoday.ca. And if you'd like hearing Scott and I talk, go listen to the latest Canby report, where we talked.
Yes, about all things Vancouver politics. Well, actually, not all things, because we had to cut a bunch for time, but a lot of interesting stuff in Vancouver politics. But we'll just leave it there before we lose our Fort St. John listeners.
Let's jump into it then. A conventional end. Let's recap effectively the BC NDP convention and the end of the legislature, since it all goes together. The provincial party, for whatever reason, held its now biannual, every other year convention in the week before the last week of the legislature sitting in Victoria.
Seems I guess like bad scheduling on their part.
I guess all their people were in Victoria.
Well, all their MLAs were in Victoria.
The and a lot of
the staff.
People
from the riding associations and whatnot do have to come out.
And it's interesting. The BCNDP, a couple of years ago, made the controversial move within the party to move from annual conventions to every other year conventions. Some say to limit the chance of the members embarrassing the party, as I think every party is worried about these days. The party, I think, would argue that it's more about saving money and making it a bigger, more exciting spectacle, which this year...
This was not a spectacle, though. Most people could be forgiven for not knowing it happened.
I think there were a couple extra headlines about Jagmeet Singh being there, about John Horgan's speech, and that's what they wanted. There wasn't a lot of talk about what was actually passed at the convention. So an ideal convention of yore would be when the members of the party get together and decide what the party is about, and then the party enacts that if they're in government.
That's today, not how things really work, though.
Yeah, today it's more a party to celebrate the fact you're in government, or a party to woe the fact you're not.
Or rally the troops to become government.
But in neither case are the party brass really interested in what the members have to say. In fact, there was a apparently decent debate about whether there should be a 2-minute or a 3-minute speaking length for members at the party. They settled on a 3-minute, so go
okay,
democracy.
It allows them to run out the clock, I guess, too, for the less popular motion or proposals that get generally pushed down the order paper on this.
There's some procedural ones that can always come up. The biggest thing that always comes up at a convention, though, is, you know, how popular is the leader? And, you know, this is what turfed Mulcair.
What we'll be watching for in April when it happens to Andrew Scheer. But that's the next segment.
In the Ralph Klein days in the Progressive Conservative government in Alberta, it would be, you know, what percentage of the membership vote does he get? And there's no, I mean, the official cutoff is if you get under 50%, you have to leave. But then there's that vague range of like 50 to 70, roughly, percent, where you don't have a strong showing of support from your team, the people who should like you. And so the question is, you know, can you get a good vote from the delegates? And John Horgan, did pretty well this year.
Yeah, so he pulled in 96% of the vote, which for a popular premier in his first term is not a surprise.
I love the 3.6% of BCNDP members who are like, fuck John Horgan.
No doubt disappointed that he's running a fairly moderate and safe government.
Beyond that vote of support, the motions passed. And I even saw NDP MLAs trying to like pump them up as like exciting, big changes for the party. And it was just like...
Is there anything exciting? I'm looking at the list here and there's nothing that's really, you know, making me want to stand up and cheer.
So the things they're pumping up are expanding free menstrual products to all public buildings, which I think is fine. That's good. That is a reasonable policy. And lowering the voting age to 16, which I also support and is good. It's not radical, though. Maybe the voting age.
The voting age one's a bit.
Ending parking fees at hospitals for patients and visiting family. It's a populist policy.
Yeah. And even for the people who don't particularly like free parking, like hospitals is kind of one of those ones that they're not going to get too worked up about anyway. And besides, the parking policy nerds are such a small segment, it's not really going
to matter. I mean, as someone who's had to do a lot of trips to BC Children's and... frankly, Burnaby General for prenatal classes. Parking fees at hospitals are annoying and they're expensive. Parking's also just annoying and difficult at hospitals. Like BC Children's, Women and Children's is almost always full and their parking rate is like $14.50 a day. It's fairly steep. Apparently it needs to be steeper for the market to kick in, or there's just such an inelastic demand that I don't
I
know what you do.
Hospitals tend to be fairly inelastic.
So fine, let's find a way to make it better for patients and visiting family, but again, not radical stuff. Like building SkyTrains to every hospital, good stuff. The Burnaby Hospital is nowhere near transit. Luckily, there actually is a shuttle that goes from, this is deep in the weeds, Patterson to Burnaby Hospital to Willingdon Station and back and forth.
Okay,
Brentwood.
But yeah, that's...
And that's free, I think, but it's not really advertised.
Burnaby also has large swaths of transit inaccessibleness, so that's not a surprise.
And the other exciting motion is to pressure Ottawa for cheaper cell and internet plans. The NDP is not planning to nationalize anything. They just want the federal government to do more, which...
Yeah, because they did put forward a bill I think's passed. Or...
The NDP campaigned on
a pricing transparency bill.
Right.
Using the slight sliver of regulatory power they have over telecommunications.
I mean, I think there's even smaller ones. There was apparently a debate over whether we should be on daylight time or standard time when we get rid of daylight savings time. The delegates...
Which one won?
Daylight time, summertime, which is what I prefer. There are SFU academics, the only time I'll disagree with the ivory tower, who think that, you know, it's better for your health to have more sun in the morning. And I'm like, I like going home with sun and having it like after work. That's good for me. And bringing in a school lunch program was also supported. And also they updated some of their names of the internal committees, like the Aboriginal People's Committee is now like the Indigenous People's Committee. Controversial stuff. They did, however, debate whether or not to press the BCNDP on the $400 a year renter's rebate that the party famously ran on and never did anything about.
And now is pretty much officially dead.
Yeah, members decided to endorse the party brass's idea that, you know what, this isn't actually such a good idea, and let's not, you know, force this issue. I think we've debated on the podcast before.
The provincial government has a program that is literally just a grant of money to homeowners. So on one hand, it does make sense to, if you're just giving people money to live in a place, to do it for both types of tenure. On the other hand, we shouldn't be doing the first one anyway, and the major constraint on rents has to do with there just not being enough apartments, not people having an extra $400 or not in the year, although there will definitely be people that, you know, that makes a difference for.
Yeah, so renter's rebate's not going forward. I mean, the funny thing about policies passed at convention is they're not binding in any way, apparently, anymore. Like the federal Liberal Party passed a decriminalize all drugs, I believe, motion at one of their policy conventions. And Trudeau's not campaigning on that. He's not going to do that.
Yeah. What gets passed at conventions and what makes it into the platform are two completely different things decided by different people.
And here we have a convention not even passing interesting things. So maybe something more fun will come up by the time the NDP runs for re-election. But we might be in store for a very boring time. And that's not to say there aren't pressing crises facing British Columbia. At the time of the convention, the bus system here in Vancouver looked like it was about to shut down under strike. I mean, SkyTrain still is about to.
Well, not for like a month or so of further negotiations, and then maybe a strike.
The forestry industry is in massive decline and needs some kind of optimism or hope, and that affects a lot of the interior of British Columbia, where the NDP should be hoping to build some gains if they want to be a truly provincial party. Looking at different ways to continue to expand our approach to tackling climate change feels like something ambitious. There's lots of opportunity to do more. And I'm not even saying they need to go full left or radical. They can just be more creative than what we saw on offer. So I think they achieved their aim of being boring, which is, you know, the best a government can aim for, I guess.
Maybe. Do a little more aspirational, probably, even if you're a government.
I think that's what we hope for. The reality is, like, the reason people like Mike Harris managed to stick around for quite a while is a lot of it, or Dalton McGuinty, was a lot of their governing was pretty boring. It was pretty dry. It was just a matter of, like, not attracting scandal.
Well, towards the end with McGuinty.
Oh, yeah. After a while, they all start to approach, you know, bring in too much scandal and stuff goes bad. But in Horgan's only in his first term.
Yes, we have no gas plant scandals here yet.
But on the other hand, that also kind of highlights what the last week of the legislature was boring. We talked about last week all the bills that were left on the order paper. Unsurprisingly, they all managed to get passed.
Well, all the government bills got passed. There's a bunch of private members' bills that didn't get passed and that will likely be removed from the order paper when the procedural proroguing before the throne speech happens.
Yeah, they're all effectively dead today. I was heckling Greens on Twitter today about, well, technically the bills aren't dead until prorogation, but that's not till January, and there's not going to be an emergency session, so all the bills are dead. I mean, the highlight of this week was the UNDRIP bill passing. That was guaranteed to pass, but it did go unanimously, which was good to see. It's nice to see that there is kind of a unanimous party consensus in BC around some of these issues.
Yeah, although that one, the controversial stuff or the things that will likely be points of contention going forward were not in this bill. So that makes it fairly easy to pass what is largely an aspirational bill.
Hey, this same bill could not get through the Senate federally. Actually, a less strong version of this bill where the Conservatives stonewalled it and let it die on the order paper. So the fact BC Liberals, BC Greens, and BC NDP were all behind this, I'm going to celebrate. Let's take an aspiration for an aspiration. Are there any other highlights, though, for you more broadly for this last year of the legislature? We'll do our full year in review later, but just looking at the legislative session as it comes to a close.
Well, I mean, small potatoes, but the daylight savings one I'm happy to see moving forward on.
It will make... It's sort of like local politics stuff where, in a way, it doesn't really matter, but it will make a huge difference for so many people's daily lives. Like now having a child, I'm like, oh yeah, time change is awful. It's so terrible. You get a schedule down with someone who doesn't understand time or clocks, let alone why we change them twice a year arbitrarily. Yeah, let's get rid of that. Make everyone's life better and cause less accidents and have less hospital visits because people are tired. So that's good.
Yeah, overall, the government's kind of at that mid-mandate point where they're working through a lot of the stuff, but nothing, I don't want to say nothing huge, but it's more or less we're in management mode.
Yeah, they checked off a lot of campaign promises in the first year, year and a half. So things are a little less exciting now. And those things they are trying to pass are far more technical, like how to fix ICBC, which no one has a solution to yet, but it seems like it's going to be lots of little boring technical things that don't make for as exciting news. At the same time, that's really presented a problem for the BC Liberals, who have struggled to gain traction on anything. I mean, unless you disagree, do you think they've had a successful year in any way?
Not really. Yeah, they haven't really found an issue that they've really been able to gain traction. Some of the forestry stuff, I think, is going to lay out, but that's also largely concentrated in ridings already held by BC Liberals.
Yeah, that's the biggest problem for them there.
Which, like, makes it hard to grow their coalition on that issue.
It doesn't make it not important.
Yeah.
And it's worth raking the government over, you know, how are we going to support this industry that's a founding industry of the province and one that could be a sustainable part of its future and should be, because we're always going to need wood.
Yes, especially as we move into more and more mass timber construction and a bunch of other stuff like that, we will be needing a forestry industry for quite a while. But yeah, otherwise, they've done stuff like focus on Uber and ride hailing, which I think it does resonate with a lot of people, but it's not really the sort of thing you're necessarily going to, you know, go door knock for the Liberals because of ride hailing.
Well, and ride hailing's almost here. Everyone's being inundated with the ads. It might not be
The NDP will be making noises about delaying it again, so there's that. There's the community benefits agreement, which I think there's some fair criticisms on, but infrastructure funding and relative costs isn't the sort of thing that really gets people riled up unless there's a clear boondoggle.
Yeah, not until we get fast ferries.
So yeah, it's a challenge for them. I think as we talked about last episode before, whenever we looked at their trial balloon platform sort of thing, we made the point that the Liberal coalition is fairly strong. They have a high floor and their general thrust of, you know, we want a, you know, strong economy that works well, that like people can succeed in this sort of thing. I'm not doing a great job of explaining it right now, but the when they really focus on that kind of opportunity message, they tend to do fairly well. And whether or not Wilkinson's the person to do a great job at selling it, I think it remains to be seen. But despite some rockiness now, that they're not necessarily in a bad position for the next election.
Meanwhile, on the other side of the aisle, the BC Greens face a little bit more rocky of a next year, as Andrew Weaver announced this week that instead of waiting until their new leader is chosen, I think in June, he's just going to retire as leader over the break.
Yeah, kind of in early January, I think it was.
Yeah, before the legislature returns. So
which
that
is,
interim leader will lead them through the House for a few months.
Which is weird. It doesn't make much sense to me because they have two other MLAs right now who are both probably seriously thinking about leadership because, well, it's a small caucus and there isn't that many options that doesn't involve a by-election or the awkwardness of having a leader that's not in the House. But then if one of those two has to then step in as interim leader or also have that awkward not have a person in the House who's leading the party, it just gets really complicated. And Andrew Weaver said this was basically kind of, he wanted to pass the torch as quickly as possible. And
I think his words were, once you've won the Stanley Cup, you should retire. And notably, the Stanley Cup, in his view, is three seats, which was big for the BC Greens, yes. But in the, you know, politics analogy, that's like comparing politics and hockey. It's not like he won the Stanley Cup. That would be
forming a majority
government, right?
Yeah, it's barely making the playoffs. And even then, they had to tweak the rules to get official party status for three MLAs. It's a tortured metaphor, is I think the point here. And
also, he tried to reference Wayne Gretzky at one point, saying he shouldn't have played one last season. And I think I saw Justin McElroy sub-tweeting him, pointing out, like, no, actually, everyone kind of recognizes Wayne Gretzky was the greatest player, one of the greatest players ever. And sure, he may have played way more seasons after his prime than he needed to, but we still all agree he was great. And no one, like, super begrudges Gretzky for sticking around. It's just a bad analogy.
It's a bad metaphor. It's a weird one to then base a strategy on a transfer of power within the Green Party around, because it does leave that really awkward situation of, okay, how do you run a party where there's a good chance everybody in the caucus will be seeking the leadership?
Weaver has, I believe, told the media he's heard from three people who are seriously considering throwing their hats in the ring. And that's all he said.
Okay.
So it's more than just the two who are in the party.
Yeah, but then you also have the awkward complication that Andrew Weaver's going to stick around until the Nets election, and without a by-election to bring someone in, if the third person who isn't an MLA is the one who ends up winning the leadership race, well, then you have the same problem Jade Meet Singh ran into, where nobody really cares what the leader's doing if they're not actually in the legislature.
All that's to say, the Greens are in a very weird place.
And so weird, and like, self-inflicted place. Like, it's entirely reasonable to decide that you want to step down as leader and have a clear path for the party to replace it. Changing plans mid-course adds unnecessary complications and challenges.
I do get sitting out or finishing off this session and feeling like you're complete, but you could have telegraphed that in advance. Last thing I just want to touch on is kind of a personal work thing that happened just this morning in the legislature. Mike Farnworth, government House leader, gets up and presents a motion, a very procedural sounding motion, to change in the standing orders the words prayers to prayers and reflections. And I believe you talked with Shannon about the campaign that launched as I went on parental leave from the BC Humanist Association to end the prayers in the legislature, and talked about how religious they were from the data we did. And it seems that has prompted a little bit of change. We know that the clerk's office has issued new standardized prayers for MLAs to choose from, which they don't have to choose from. They can write their own whatever statements they want about beef or boats or Almighty God. And now I think this second bit kind of reflects a desire among all MLAs to be a little more inclusive. What was most interesting to me was I saw on Twitter Lori Thronis, one of the most religious MLAs in the House, championing this as, you know, his idea in the first place.
Okay.
It's a fun day when I'm on the same side of an issue as Lori Thronis. Anyway, I retweeted him. Good work. I'm happy. This is a good start. It's a baby step. I'll also note that 10 years ago was when the University of Alberta changed its convocation charge from asking every graduate to use your degree for the glory of God and honor of your country to a longer charge that included the phrase, for all who believe to serve your God, which feels like the same kind of interim change that was later repealed in favor of a fully secularish stance. So I look forward to continuing to push for change in the BC legislature.
Moving on to segment two, oppositions to the opposition. There's a bunch of news out of Ottawa this week as the shape of the opposition parties in Parliament begins to take shape.
And as people continue to, behind the scenes and increasingly in front of the scenes, voice their trepidation about Andrew Scheer continuing on.
Well, what's more interesting, I think, is the people who aren't voicing much, which is namely the people who want Andrew Scheer to stay on. You hear a lot of people, and an increasingly large amount, as we'll get to in a moment, from pretty much every faction of the Conservative Party. But you rarely see people unprompted say that Andrew Scheer should stay on. You get the occasional, you know, when pressed, oh, yes, I support the leader statements, but nobody is proactively coming out to say, yes, Andrew Scheer really needs to be the leader of the Conservative Party. But this week we added a bunch of new names to the people who want Andrew Scheer not to be leader of the Conservative Party anymore, including Jenny Bryan, the former Harper campaign director. There's a new organization headed by former Harper PMO staffer and his communications director, Tory Tonight.
I think so.
Tonight.
He's teamed up with a bunch of people from like post-millennial, the increasingly serious conservative rag blog paper. I don't know.
Online media outlet.
Yeah. Like, it's not as bad as The Rebel, but it was a blog and now it's more of like, oh, it. I don't know what it is, but they apparently don't like Andrew Scheer.
Yes. Also, the Quebec wing of the party is in revolt, saying that he can't win in Quebec, which is true. Also, there were calls from social conservatives this week who are angry at Andrew Scheer for not standing up enough for social conservatism, which puts them opposed to the, you know, GTA conservatives who are raking Scheer over the coals for being too socially conservative. So he's really in a bit of a no-win scenario where all the factions of the party, who we kind of pieced together their reluctant, you know, fourth place choices in the leadership race, all of them are now saying, hey, we could do better.
It's incredible how much power and winning can do to tamp down dissent in any situation. You know, like, compare this to the BC NDP. They're in power. No one really has anything bad to say about John Horgan, even though I was going to say he's fairly milquetoast, but that was before the dad jokes and that persona came through. Meanwhile, Andrew Scheer could be the dad type. He's in a lot of ways that exact character for the,
yeah, like the
conservatives, except he didn't win.
Yeah.
Or
he did have a
didn't
decent...
come close enough to win to be able to get power through a weird.
He's also just, I think, a little too awkward to do it. He actually had a decent thing during the campaign of, I think, Simpsons trivia on 22 Minutes, and he's apparently a surprisingly knowledgeable Simpsons trivia buff. But like that sort of like personalizing stuff largely was nowhere to be seen.
So Scheer did try to do a bit this week to stave off some of the criticism, namely blaming it on other people. He fired his chief of staff and communications director in an effort to try to, you know, sacrifice someone. That didn't seem to work. He also announced who his leadership team would be. The critics will be announced later, but he appointed Leona Aleslev, who we mentioned briefly when she crossed the floor from the Liberals to the Conservatives,
which
from
was only
one backbench to the other.
I believe was less than a year ago. Anyway, the point, she's actually spent more time on the Liberal benches than the Conservative benches, which is odd for a deputy leader. Although in another sense, it does kind of make sense in that this is someone who is largely in the Lisa Raitt mold, a moderate from the GTA, who's a woman. So in that sense, it kind of follows the existing pattern of that and offsets Scheer somewhat. But yeah, that pretty big asterisk of being a recent floor crosser makes it weird.
The spin they're doing is she's the type of MP, voter, person the Conservatives need to be winning. We just don't quite trust the Liberals anymore, and therefore we'll go with the Conservatives, especially around Toronto, because the Conservatives did win more votes in the last election. They just ran them up in Alberta when they should have been breaking through anywhere else, frankly.
Although that idea around is what they ran their campaign on. It didn't work then. Well, we'll just let everyone see how terrible Trudeau is and they'll eventually come over to us. Didn't work.
The rest of the leadership team doesn't show much change. Elaine Reyes stays as Quebec lieutenant. Candace Bergen stays on as house leader and Mark Strahl stays on as whip. They're all long-serving, competent MPs. So there's nothing really to say there. But yeah, not a great week for Andrew Scheer with so many different names coming forward publicly. Because prior to this, it was largely unnamed conservative sources are grumbling about Andrew Scheer. And now you have a lot of people associated with Stephen Harper's leadership and campaigns coming out and going, we don't think this is the way to go. And we'll see if next it's former MPs or sitting MPs. But the battle is still to come in April, because it sounds like Andrew Scheer is going to be sticking around until then. And
it'd be good for the Conservative Party if he left sooner and, you know, maybe take some time over the holidays to change his mind on that or reconsider. But it's shaping up to be something that gets dragged out till April, even though that makes finding a new leader before a minority parliament falls more of a challenge.
Well, let's go from the Conservatives to the smaller opposition bench of the
Bloc Québécois.
Well,
down one level below that.
Down one below that, because I don't know who the Bloc has as their critics, if they've named them. And this is a BC politics podcast. So let's talk about the NDP, who have named a lot of BC MPs to critic roles, because
that's where a lot of their caucus is from.
Well, and every NDP MP got something, because there's only 24 of them. So when there's a ministry of 35, I believe it is, everybody has to be a critic or two.
So who got to be the critic for the middle class?
Ah, their NDP doesn't believe in middle class prosperity. We're against that. Charlie Angus, I think, is the closest. He got named critic for income inequality and affordability, which, if we're going to do class-based ministries, that seems more reasonable as, like, let's try to solve some of these issues rather than just... No one knows what the middle-class ministry is going to do yet.
Yeah.
Who they will represent.
Yeah, Beaver Daddy called it the Ministry of Political Sloganeering.
Well, in that sense, then I think the best opposing person from the NDP is going to be Nikki Ashton, who was named Critic for Public Ownership, which is like the NDP's version of middle-class prosperity. And now we just need to wait for the Conservative Minister of Defending Supply Management. I put it out to our patrons to try to find other, you know, good ideas. Someone suggested the critic for attacking the carbon tax.
I mean, knowing this version of the Conservative Party, it's probably just going to be the Minister for Trudeau's a duty head, because that is literally their only messaging right now.
Going through the rest of the NDP critics, there's some interesting moves. A lot of people stayed on the same things, like Don Davies stayed on health. Jenny Kwan from Vancouver's on housing. I don't know if she was on that before. Jugmeet Singh gave himself, interestingly, both being the critic for Crown Indigenous Relations and Indigenous Services and Intergovernmental Affairs.
So there's two ways to read that. One of them is, this is the leader indicating that these are very important critic roles. The other way to read that is, he's the leader. His attention is going to be focused on everything that that entails, and giving himself those roles, whether intentional or not, will ultimately minimize them.
I think those roles are held by very senior people in Trudeau's cabinet. So if he's going to be asking questions, the NDP has already talked about that one of their red lines is the Human Rights Tribunal case around Indigenous child welfare. So it's clearly a priority issue. And so by taking the critic roles to himself, he's therefore going to be the person asking the questions in question period about that.
Well, the thing is, he can always be that person. You don't need to necessarily have your critic for that. And I think back to the early Trudeau cabinet where he was the Minister for Intergovernmental Affairs, and nothing happened on that really because, well, he's also party leader and prime minister, who admittedly has a little more going on, but one person can only wear so many hats effectively, and taking on these runs rather than delegating them out among, you know, well-performing caucus members might not end up with these getting the attention they deserve or that the NDP actually wants to have there.
We'll have to see how well he is at balancing multiple different hats. Well, lots of other people are wearing lots of different hats. Local MP Peter Julian is going to be both House Leader and Finance Critic. Alexander Boularis has a ton of different roles. He's Deputy Leader. He's also the Critic for Canadian Economic Development for Quebec Regions and the Critic for Canadian Heritage, neither of which are, I think, huge ministries.
No.
But
Heritage typically goes to Quebec.
And he is the only Quebec MP, and so he's, in a way, still, like, very prominent, and the NDP wants to make sure they...
Don't lose their
him.
Last seat.
Yeah. The youngest MP, I think she's the youngest MP, Mumalakkak, the new MP for Nunavut. She's the critic for Northern Affairs, which
makes sense.
A lot of sense. She'll be really interesting to watch in the legislature because she's a young Inuit woman who's, like, really raised her profile and won what I don't think anyone was really watching for the NDP to pick up a seat up north. And so...
It's the territory... Like, the territories... unfortunately tend to be an afterthought in elections. So yeah, that I think caught a lot of people by surprise, but also unfortunate that nobody was really watching that race as it developed.
The rest I wrote down in here are all BC MPs who got different roles. Rachel Blaney was announced as whip early, I think over the convention, as one of the leaders or one of the leadership team. Taylor Barak, who took over Nathan Cullen's seat up in Skeena-Bulk Valley, is now the critic for infrastructure and communities. They need more infrastructure up north and everywhere. But it'll be interesting to see if he's able to advocate as well for urban infrastructure coming from such a rural riding. Richard Cannings from South Okanagan is the critic for natural resources, which is also going to be a tough file for the NDP, where they're fighting Trans Mountain still officially and trying to support more sustainable natural resource development.
Although without... having to try and avoid stepping on the Alberta NDP toes as they were government, and that's no longer the case. They at least have a little more wiggle room. Although I'm sure the Alberta NDP didn't feel like they were given enough of due when they were government.
That's where I thought Jagmeet Singh as critic for intergovernmental affairs would have been really interesting if he had to debate Rachel Notley on the issues. And finally, Laurel Collins, the new MLA for Victoria who took over Murray Rankin's seat, she was appointed critic for environmental and climate change, which is pretty awesome. I'd been following her since a little bit when she was on Victoria City Council, and I think she's more on the eco-socialist wing, so she'll be rabble-rousing quite a bit. And I think I see that trend with Nikki Ashton's public ownership in transport and some of these other brands. Like, Nikki Ashton's already running a survey on what should we nationalize next, just to get feedback from members and the random public. There is a continuation, I think, of the more left campaign that the NDP ran than previously in this shadow cabinet. Is there a shadow cabinet if it's their fourth party?
I don't think there's a requirement that shadow cabinets be limited to the official opposition.
Okay.
It's not a formal term anyway. Like,
yeah.
Shadow cabinet doesn't get you extra parliamentary funding or anything.
Yeah. I mean, there's some changes I would have liked to have seen. Maybe taking Don Davies out of health after his, what was he promoting? Naturopathy, or was it homeopathy?
Might have been homeopathy. One of the quack medicine sort of things. I can't recall exactly which. Oh, there's some anti-vax stuff in there too, was it?
Yeah, there was a connection to that. Could have just had someone else. He just might know the other parts of health better. There was a small pool from which to draw, I guess. It'll be interesting. Yeah, I'll be watching to see who stands out from this. I also saw Edmonton Strathcona's new MP, which is a former riding where I lived, Heather McPherson, named critic for international development, which I hope she does well in. Well, let's move into a third shorter segment. Your IQ was aggregated. This week, that little BC startup that could aggregate IQ made a ton of international news as Michael McAvoy, the Information and Privacy Commissioner for BC, and Daniel Therrien, the Privacy Commissioner of Canada, released this tag team joint report of awesomeness investigating.
That's the first time anyone has used that adjective to describe a privacy commissioner's report.
They wanted to look at, quote, whether the actions of Aggregate IQ were consistent with Canadian laws, whether they took measures required to ensure it had the legal authority to use and disclose, among other things, UK voter information in the way it did. And they found, quote, that in the context of its work related to Brexit, it did not.
So you should probably actually tell the listeners who may not be aware what Aggregate IQ is. They're a Victoria-based tech/political communications and operations firm that focuses, or at least does a lot of work with regards to social media and voter data. And they specifically, they have ties to Cambridge Analytica and have had questions, very serious ones, raised about the use of voter data to try and influence outcomes of elections.
Yeah, as far as I can tell, the stuff they would tend to do is around the next step beyond micro-targeting. So you try to identify from social media behavior the type of people who would vote for you and then serve them ads to encourage them to.
Yeah, and I don't know if Facebook has changed. They've revamped a lot of their political advertising in the recent years, but it used to be, I think, that you could just upload a list of emails and have it micro-target to the accounts that are tied to those emails and a bunch of stuff like that. And data really drives a lot of campaigns in terms of voter identification, targeting of ads, get out the vote. It's really important to just running a campaign, and having a good data operation can be the difference between winning and losing.
And it's that uploading of emails to target people that in part got Aggregate IQ in trouble with these privacy commissioners, because BC and Canadian privacy laws are pretty clear that you need to get explicit consent for what you do with someone's data. And in their work with the Vote Leave campaign on Brexit, as well as here in BC work with a provincial party, certain candidates in the 2017 provincial election, a candidate for leadership of a provincial party, which must have been a BC Liberal.
I believe I haven't checked this recently, but I believe Todd Stone had some controversies around him using Adrian at IQ.
And finally, a municipal slate in the 2018 local elections, which we couldn't figure out who was. I think it might have, my suspicion it would probably be the NPA here in Vancouver, but I don't know that for sure.
It was Todd Stone, just checked.
I think the provincial party was also the BC Greens, if I recall correctly, but I could be wrong about this. They were also involved with a mayoral campaign in St. John's, Newfoundland, of all places. You know, tight stakes out there on the East Coast. What they ran into, though, is people would sign up for a petition or campaign updates from various political parties or for various causes. And when you sign those petitions or sign up for updates, you agree to the privacy policy of that campaign. And the privacy commissioners looked at those policies and said, okay, these are good or bad to varying degrees, but basically none of them said a third party, Aggregate IQ, would be allowed to take your email, give it to Facebook, and then let you be served ads of varying intensity. And that's where a lot of the trouble was given, as well as they were also dinged for not securing the data very well. And it's tough, but if you're going to be collecting a lot of people's private information, you need to have good routines and procedures in place not to lose that. And so there's a suite of recommendations in this fairly short report, 36 pages or something like that, basically outlining how Aggregate IQ needs to behave much better in the future.
Yeah, privacy laws and how they intersect with political parties and political campaigns has been an issue for a while. And a lot of the privacy laws specifically have an opt out or exclude political parties because they're the ones who write these laws and they don't want that stuff to apply to them. So that's been a challenge. But I think over the last, 3 years now, basically since 2016, the role that social media and data collection has had in political campaigns has, I think, come into a lot sharper focus. And how the response to that shapes up is something I don't think anyone's really figured out yet and still developing.
Yeah, and this story drew a lot of attention because a lot of outlets are quick to go, ah, this is proof that there was meddling in the Brexit referendum or they helped get Trump elected or this or that. And it's murkier than that. There's ways to use this nefariously, and people are arguably being more polarized by this kind of micro-targeting that stops people from talking to one another and kind of helps silo each other. I mean, that's what social media does in general. And it's just tempting to want to find this is the one thing that caused that thing I didn't like, ah, it was the Russians or foreign interference. And it's all more complicated than that. And as you point out, there's so many unanswered questions here. One of the things the BC Privacy Commissioner has previously looked at was, how good are our political parties with our data? And the answer here in BC is really bad, because it turns out political parties who write the rules about data privacy don't want to apply them to themselves for obvious reasons.
Nor do they necessarily have the resources to properly secure all the data.
I mean, that applies just as much to small charities that collect data.
Yes, it applies to a lot of groups. Generally, I think there's concern that a data breach in a political party may be more serious than a charity, depending on what that data is, because it has the potential to have influence on the outcome of a campaign. But, you know, the incentive structure within political parties is also really bad for this, because they never have enough resources, and the resources they do have doesn't get put to data security or anything. It goes to winning the next campaign, and that's just a really tough nut to crack. I think the CSE has offered help to federal parties, if I recall. But it's the sort of thing that, yeah, you have to have pretty strong mandates for in order to actually get them to comply with that, or bring in outside help in the form of the government security experts. CSE being the Communication Security Establishment, basically our version of the NSA.
The more boring one. The BCCLA is
actually
doing
a lower profile.
The BC Civil Liberties Association is doing a ton of great work trying to get more information on what CSEC knows about Canadians and what kind of digital spying they're actually doing. And the answer is, we can't tell you, because it's all under lock and key, even the hearings, to find out what they're doing. One thing I just want to leave off with is Sancho, one of our patrons, has been telling us about how hard it's been for him to try to find out what political parties know about him. And he quotes there from a letter he got from a political party asking for more information before they tell him what they know about him. And they say, please include your mailing address in your request. If it matches the address we hold for your name on file, we will send your information by mail. It is our practice to issue our response by mail so that the confidential information contained in the response is properly delivered to the intended recipient. Anyone who's ever gotten data from a political party knows they're terrible at keeping shit up to date, though. So, like, I've lived at two addresses this year. I know the BCNDP is still sending stuff to my old address. I'm still on the, like, records for that constituency association. Do I have to use that address to mail them to get my information? Or do I use my new address? Do I have to use both? What happens then with that information that I've just sent them, which contains new addresses or old addresses? Do they put that in a file? This just raises more questions than answers and is very problematic for, like, data security. So just promising stuff. Anyway, the point is, join our Slack and you can find out more about these kind of conversations. Patreon.com/politicoast.
Well, let's move on to Twit Takes to round this episode out. We have yet another Senate story. It's just the gift that keeps on giving.
It's a recurring segment. The story this week is that the Bayak is back. Actually, Lynn Bayak returned to the Senate on September 11th. She had been suspended from the Senate, for those who don't recall, for posting very racist anti-Indigenous letters on her website and then claiming that that's just her free speech and she's being persecuted if people tell her not to do that.
Turns out the Senate's ethics body didn't exactly agree with that interpretation, and she ended up being suspended until the end of term, which happened on September 11th when the writ was dropped, ending the parliamentary term. And since then, she's been back on the Senate's payroll.
She claims to have completed the 5 Ethics Committee recommendations, which include things like attending anti-racist programs at her own expense, apologizing to her fellow senators, and otherwise trying to be a better human being. A lot of people are understandably skeptical because she was pretty awful in going through that whole fiasco. I think this was back in like a year ago and early 2019. She's notably not reposted the racist letters since then. But I think we'll find out in the coming week when the Ethics Committee reconvenes to reconsider Senator Lynn Bayak, which all kind of goes to show, like, if we're going to have an unelected body of Canadians with some say in our laws, is this the best we can do? Like, there are some great senators. There are some good people in the Senate. Let's not tarnish them all. But, like, does she need to be there?
Probably not. And she may not be, depending on how that Ethics Committee goes. So we'll be keeping an eye on that.
Anyway, the Senate, the gift that keeps on giving. But let's move out to New Brunswick, where this week their education minister, Dominic Carty, unexpectedly dropped the notwithstanding clause into a bill. I guess New Brunswick has been trying for a couple years to pass a bill banning non-medical exemptions to vaccines. This is the idea that you can't just, like, go and be like, I really don't like them, or my religion precludes me from having vaccines. It's only people who just had heart surgery or
the other reasons. The other legitimate medical reasons why that can't happen. We're not doctors. We're not going to go through those. But the long and the short of it is they just didn't really want to fight it out in court. So they threw down the notwithstanding clause preemptively on this one.
Not just that, but I love Carty's specific comments in the CBC article. He's calling out what he calls, quote, an organized, well-financed lobby out there that's intent on derailing efforts to protect vulnerable children.
But that, quote, organized, well-financed lobby out there has already said they're going to proceed with a lawsuit nonetheless.
No, he calls those people folks who've got nothing but conspiracies and medieval fantasies to base their arguments upon, and they just want to have expensive court costs for the province.
So this is one case where a politician just saying it like it is something I am entirely on board for. I'm less enthused about preemptively using the notwithstanding clause, even if I agree with the particular policy that it's being used to implement.
Yeah, I'm not an ends justify the means kind of person, and so this makes me very uneasy, even though I agree with the ends.
Yeah, at least let it settle through the courts first. Like, I mean, I get that they don't want to do the hassle of it, but, you know, at least let it go through the normal judicial review and also vaccinate your kids.
I guess what they're hoping is New Brunswick's going to have this be a free vote on whether to include the notwithstanding clause. So individual, I believe it's MLAs, might be MHAs, might be MNAs. I forget, out east.
I live there.
Individual legislature, individual legislators will be able to decide their conscience on whether other people can use their conscience, ironically.
Anyway, so this is going to be an interesting one to watch, both because that is a rare free vote and also because it's a somewhat unprecedented. Actually, I'm not sure if some of the Quebec notwithstanding clause uses around the language bills were preemptive or not. That little bit of political history I'm not up on enough. And they did do a period of just putting it in everything as a protest.
And Bill 21 was preemptive.
Oh, yeah, there is that.
Laïcité.
Doing preemptive notwithstanding clauses does kind of rub me the wrong way, and it would be better to let the courts deal with it first, and then, if needed, come back and apply the notwithstanding clause. So yeah, we'll see how the MLAs vote there. Moving back here to BC, the Union of BC Municipalities has decided to ban foreign governments from sponsoring events at their convention. The particular foreign government that sparked the controversies around this is the Chinese government. And this has been a source of controversy for a couple of years now. But they've been hosting a kind of welcome...
It's like a luncheon. It's a worth luncheon, like $6,000.
Yeah.
So it's probably not a nothing sponsorship, but it's not the biggest for a large conference.
I think but this touches on the Chinese government's long stand, but particularly more recent and visible attempts to exert more influence abroad. And the UBCM has been one of the main points at which that criticism's focused around, in particular, just because it was so kind of out there and visible.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not in favor of permitting foreign governments to sponsor this. This seems like a reasonable move. The rhetoric around it has just been so like hyperbolic that I just get turned off of this story.
Yeah, so this has actually been a challenge, especially out here in BC, where there is a fair bit of racism and xenophobia around Chinese Canadians and new arrivals to this country, which makes this conversation difficult and also off-putting in a lot of ways. And it, I think particularly noticeable in the lower mainland. And it's made dealing with the challenges of an increasingly assertive China that's exerting power well outside of its borders difficult to deal with.
Well, and the thing that gets me is the UBCM says, all right, we'll ban the foreign governments, but we're not going to look at banning corporations or unions from sponsoring things because, you know, that money helps keep the conference affordable for municipalities. Which is true, but if we're worried about influence for the sake of influence, then let's be a little more, like, cover all the ways money is getting in.
There's a little, yeah.
Like I said, I think, not the end of the world, but...
Yeah, I think the geopolitical implications that are a little stronger than necessarily unions or corporations throwing the odd event out there, but... And just in general, how Canada's going to be relating to China, I think it's going to be one of the big challenges of the next 50 years of Canadian politics. And I expect we'll see a lot more moves like this going forward.
Well, and finally, good news out of the BC courts this week, as the first test of the new anti-SLAPP law was ruled upon. In this case, Chilliwack school trustee Barry Neufeld had sued former BCTF president Glenn Hansman for calling him a bigot and a transphobe and saying he should be kept away from children based on his homophobic and transphobic comments about SOGI, the sexual orientation and gender identity curriculums. They went to court over this defamation case, and Glenn Hansman said, I should have the right to say these things because freedom of expression and it's public debate and grow up. And he won. Barry Neufeld got slapped down. The court did not rule on the legitimacy of either person's claims. They just said these are fair comment and should be welcome in the public sphere. So I think I am okay. I'm not a lawyer, but I think I'm okay to now say that Barry Neufeld has made too many transphobic comments and is a bigot.
I think we're in the clear on that one.
And if not, that was satire.
I guess good to see the anti-slap legislation being used.
And this felt like a pretty good test case of it. They were kind of both equally prominent figures, I think. The ideal case is where someone with significantly more power is trying to silence, like, the little guy. In this case, they were both prominent public figures.
Yeah, president of the BCTF isn't exactly the little guy.
Yeah, if anything, he might have been slightly more prominent than Barry Neufeld.
But a school trustee in one district, yes.
The court also points out he got reelected. So it clearly, his reputation wasn't so damaged by these comments that he couldn't function. Still, it was a good law, good to see it passed, and it saved the court system and both these guys a bunch of money that would have been otherwise wasted on this petty fight.
And that has been Politos. Find links to everything we talked about at politos.ca. Support the show and get access to our exclusive Slack channel at patreon.com/politos. Our intro music is Beautiful British Columbia by Sir Snip Wattenkoff. Editing services are provided by Cortado Productions. Thanks for listening.